This is The Hollywood Outsider, a weekly entertainment podcast with a new episode available each week at thehollywoodoutsider.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite app. My name is Aaron Peterson, and I'll be your host for this special episode of The Hollywood Outsider. As our loyal listeners know, every once in a while we like to bring you interviews with filmmakers to give you insight into both what goes into getting their projects made, as well as insight into the respective art itself. Now for this episode, I am speaking with Michael Yuzerski, who's the composer of Blindspotting, the new indie film that has film fanatics all over the country screaming its praises. But you might not know what it is, so I'm going to tell you. Blindspotting, which is in theaters now, follows the friends of Colin and Miles. Now, Colin has only 3 days to go on his probation. All he has to do is stay out of trouble. Unfortunately, his best friend Miles is kind of a beacon for it. As Colin and Miles work together as movers, an event causes Colin to miss his mandatory curfew, and then it puts their friendship to an ultimate test. Great film. I think you're really going to enjoy it. Be sure to find it. You might have to seek it out because it is an independent film, so it's a little, you know, it's playing more in art house cinema, so find those and definitely go check it out. We need to support movies like this. Now, Blindspotting was written by David Diggs and Rafael Casal, who also star in the movie as Colin and Miles, and the film skillfully highlights numerous factors within friendships, race, and income disparity, all set against the backdrop of Oakland. And Michael Yuzerski was given the task of meshing it all through an eclectic score covering several genres and styles, notably Oakland funk and a traditional film score. So for this exclusive interview, we talk with Michael about how he came into composing scores for film and television, what it was like working on Blindspotting, and what he hopes to achieve next. It's a really interesting interview. If you've never heard a composer talk about his craft, I think you're going to find this fascinating because he really goes into a lot of the details of how exactly it works. Now, I don't want to keep yammering on. I just want to tell you, go find the movie Blindspotting. Check it out. It is worth the watch. And definitely listen to the score. The score is beautifully crafted. I'm not just saying that because he's on the show. I really, really enjoyed his work here. He's also a great guy to talk to. So I'm just going to let his words do the talking. Here's the composer of Blindspotting, Michael Yuzerski.
Hey, Aaron.
Hey, Michael. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks so much for talking to me.
Thanks for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Of course. Yeah.
True story. It was funny. I was preparing for your interview this weekend, and yeah. I have been listening to Panic at the Disco, their new album, nonstop. And I had just watched the video before I started preparing, and then I saw that you actually composed the music for the 90-second intro.
I did.
How does that even happen?
Well, actually, I had a relationship, sort of long-going collaborative relationship with the director, Spencer Susser, and Daniel Cloud Campos. I actually did we made a short film together a few years ago called Shiny, which did really, really well and actually won a huge, they're LA-based, but it won a huge Australian short film competition called Tropfest. It's sort of, I think it's, they market it as the world's biggest short film competition. And Shiny is this incredible sort of stop motion animation. And I ran into Spencer at a film premiere, and he sort of pulled me aside. He's like, oh, are you free this weekend? Because we're doing this video clip for Panic at the Disco, and it's kind of like a live action version of this, of the concepts that we were playing around with in the film Shiny. And would you like to be involved? And I was like, yeah, well, of course. So that's how it happened. And then when I saw it, it was like, I had only seen the first 90 seconds because of, everything was under wraps. The song was under wraps, the concept of the video. So I was really just working on the sort of that build up to where, you know, in the video where all sort of hell breaks loose. It's sort of the introduction and the setup. So when I finally saw it, I was like, oh, that's amazing. So it was a really cool project to be part of.
It was really cool, and I hope everybody checks that video out. Saturday night, right?
Saturday night, yeah.
I can't make that up. I swear. I watched the video 5 minutes later. I'm doing research on you, and I see that you wrote the music for the opening to that. It was a crazy coincidence.
Yeah, no, that's cool. That's cool. No, that's fantastic. And look, I'm thrilled. It's been viewed like 19 million times or something crazy like that already. So it's been great.
Yeah, I hear it's doing okay. Yeah. Well, I always open with the same question, and from reading up on you, it was from a very young age that you could both perform and compose music. So when did you know you wanted to both compose and perform in film and television? Was there a specific moment?
When I was seven or eight, I was at the movies with, I think my dad took me to the movies, and it was, I'm pretty sure it was The Empire Strikes Back. I think it was around, it was later, so I was trying to work out the date, but I think it was around 1984, so it must have been like a rerun, or, you know, sort of a reissue of the film. Basically, at the end of the movie, I remember my dad saying to me, you know, what did you think of the film? And I was like, it's great, it's amazing, of course, I loved it as a kid. And he's like, what do you think of the music? Because I had just started playing the clarinet at that point. He's like, yeah, you know, you could do that one, write music for film. And I mean, just the thought never even occurred to me, you know. and then I sort of put that at the back of my mind for many years because I became a performer. I was performing, the clarinet was my primary instrument. I picked up the piano, I sort of taught myself the piano and then had lessons after that. And so I was really a performer for the next few years until I was 13, and I started writing. I don't even know what the impetus was, but I just wanted to write. And then I sort of pursued a formal composition, like classical composition degree. And I studied with a couple of Australia's most well-known and highly regarded composers, Peter Stelthorpe and Ross Edwards. But when I finished the degree, I was like, it sort of felt incomplete to me, my education. and then I had been, you know, looking for something else. And then there was an ad for film school, for the Australian Film Television Radio School, which had been running a film music course for only the second year in its history. I mean, the school had been around for 30 or 40 years before that, but only now they're actually doing a dedicated film music course. And I was the second year to go through. And what's incredible is as soon as I got there, I always tell people that, like, I met my people. You know, suddenly I met filmmakers and editors and, you know, production designers, cinematographers, and they were fantastic. And just socially, like, I found my peer group. And the funny thing is I still work with those same group to this day. I did a film called The Devil's Candy a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. For the same producers as Blindspotting. And, you know, I was in the same year at film school in Australia with the director, same year as the editor and the DOP. So, you know, it's just that was the impetus. Like, going to film school was really the impetus to reignite that passion. I mean, again, my dad had placed the spark in me, but it wasn't until there was actually an opportunity to pursue it that I actually followed through.
And you've been racking up credits for many, many, many years. So, I mean, you're obviously doing well. Right?
I moved with my wife to Los Angeles about 4 years ago. Prior to that, I had, and I still to this day, I think I do a lot of Australian work. And, you know, some of the productions well-known internationally, some aren't. But there's certainly been a lot of training and a lot of groundwork that I've been doing over the years, trying to get better with every gig.
Well, can I ask you, because you do have a lot of TV credits as well as film credits. Mm-hmm. What are the differences between scoring a film versus a TV show? Because we know TV has a lot more episodes, so it's a lot more work, I would think. But what's the difference for a composer?
Well, time. the main, I guess in television, you know, it's always like, you know, how soon can you get off the music? Whereas in film, it's much more about, you know, at least the films I've worked on, it's a much more sort of exploratory process of let's try this for this cue and then let's try seven more ideas and let's just see. And, you know, we've got time to play. And there's obviously, you know, I've had films where there's a time crunch, but even on those, you know, it's still very much the case that, okay, we've tried that. Could you try something else? You know, and we're talking about individual cues. Mm-hmm. Whereas in television, you might try an approach for a segment, or could you try these four or five cues differently, or this scene doesn't, you know, but it's not normally about, hey, great, we're really liking this cue, we want to hear three more versions. It's not quite like that just because of the time crunch. So it's much more get on the same page with us very quickly and deliver, which can be exhilarating. You know, I love pressure. It's like I respond really, really well to pressure. They're very, very different headspaces in a way. Mm-hmm. Even though at the end, the result is the same. And in terms of the music, you know, because a lot of the television producers that I work with hire me because I bring sort of a cinematic sound, I guess, to it. And they've sort of told me that. So, you know, we know that your music, that you've done features and the sound that you have is quite cinematic. So we want that in our shows.
Is it typically based on where the filmmaker wants to go for you up to this point, wherever they're giving you direction where to go? Or do you actually watch the scene and kind of get a feel for where you think the scene should go, and then you guys have that back and forth?
Yeah. I mean, ideally, yes, of course, you want the sort of the conversation. But I think that also depends on at what point you've been brought into the process. Like if you've been hired very late, then it's likely that a lot of the sort of music editorial decisions have been made, and they're looking for you to basically nail the emotional tone of what's already in the cut. If you're brought on early, it's much more, I think, much more a conversation of why don't we try this? Why don't we try that? Like, what are you looking for? Could this scene go either way? Especially if you're going from a script, you know, if you're hired pre-shoot, because I might read the script and go, this scene, I think, you know, is this funny? Because it reads somewhat comical on the page, and I might get back, well, yes, but I don't want the music to be comical, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's much more a conversation of how do you achieve, maybe sort of question and answer. Like a director might say to me, how do I achieve this? And I might come back with, well, you could do it three or four different ways. What do you think of this, this, or this? So definitely much more collaborative that way.
That makes me, and please don't name any names, because I'm not asking for like a gotcha kind of question or anything. Have you ever been in that position where you've written a piece for a certain particular work, and then you saw it and you're like, that's not what I thought it was meant to be like? And it just, because I've seen that many times where you see something where it feels like the music doesn't fit the piece, and you always have to wonder.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's interesting that it actually happens, I find, if I'm writing music from a script, if all I'm given is a script or a concept, and I write sort of considering, it's like, oh, okay, I think I know what this is, and I'll write the music. What I find is then after the shoot, mm-hmm. and not just the shoot, the performances, the edit, the color, the you know, the rhythm of the piece, I'll often look at it and go, you know, that piece of music I wrote pre-shoot, that's not going to work anymore. You know, and it's funny because it happens a lot, you know, and it's primarily when I'm going from script, because I don't know if I'm the world's best script reader in terms of translating what it's going to eventually look like. But it seems to me that, you know, it's often that the concept that I have, when you finally get to the other side of it, is like, it's something else now. There's so much more depth and emotional nuance and you know, all these other sort of dramatic flavors in what I'm looking at, that the music may not need to work as hard. It may need to work harder. It may be like, well, okay, I was sort of expecting more, and now I'm going to have to write a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So that happens too.
No, I totally see that, because if any film buff has read scripts, they watch the movie, you know, a lot of times there's a huge difference or disparity between the script and what you see on screen. So that's why I was always wondering, because you'll watch that, you'll see TV shows, you're like, I don't know if that's the same thing they meant. Like, they were not on the same page that day. And it's just a matter of connection, I guess, or having that same understanding for what the filmmakers are going for versus what the composer hears or sees in the page.
And I think it's also like, what is the final intent? Like, when you get to, like, whatever you were set out to achieve, this is what you have, then how can we make it the best possible version of itself? And it's like, I know that maybe you had there was the intention to make it this, but now it's something else, and it's most likely it's better, you know, it's evolved, it's you know, there are themes that are established here that weren't as apparent on the page. So how can I work with those to make this piece of cinema the most effective theme possible?
Now that brings us to Blindspotting. Much like the movie itself, and I know this word gets overused, but the score is cool. I mean, it really is cool.
Thank you.
It highlights kind of the difference between the two friends. It has this, I believe it's alluded to as Oakland funk, and a bit more standard emotional score. And it's really unique how it works, because you wouldn't think those two would go together, but they really, really do. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to those two distinct choices?
Again, like I was sort of saying, I think it's working with each scene and what each scene presents. And the incredible thing about this movie is that sort of roller coaster that it takes the audience on. And I guess my job as a composer was to make every musical choice, you know, as sort of deliberate as possible, in the sense that when the film takes a sort of a hard turn from a buddy comedy into something else, into something deeper, the music has to be there with it at all times. We can't be lingering in whatever, in the world that was set up before. Like, so when we're going from, you know, like the sort of the opening act of the film has cues that are lighter, sort of more funk based, a live band kind of sound. And in fact, there was, you know, a live band used. And then basically as the film goes on, what I'm actually doing is I'm breaking the band down. I'm breaking the sounds down. I'm putting them through musical effects and filters and stripping out layers and getting more and more spare. And in a way, that's actually reflecting the journey of the characters. And that's always kind of what I try and do in any film, is like, what are the characters going through? What are they experiencing? How can the music best represent that journey? And that's how those sort of choices were made. I mean, you're looking at, there's a cue in the film called Blind Spotting, which came about because, you know, and it's actually one of the most fair musically of the film. And it sort of came about because the producer heard one sound in one of the funk cues and said, oh, I kind of love that sound. Did you make a cue out of it? And so that kind of challenge I find really, really inspiring. And so it's like just taking one sound. How can that, like, actually sort of a keyboard sound put through a sort of a bunch of effects, but how could you just take one sound and, you know, make it drive a scene? I mean, that to me is sort of the pinnacle of creativity. You know, it's like, that's a fantastic challenge. By the same sort of token, it was a way of representing the fact that this is a relationship at its rawest. Everything had been stripped away, you know, so the music had done pretty much what the characters had done at that point.
And you wheeled in city sounds like trains. How does that work?
So when, again, on a feature film, this is where I was talking about before, it's like you sometimes have a little bit more time or leeway to experiment creatively. And we knew that part of the score would have to have a sort of a sound design element in it. And so I was basically just throwing different sounds because we needed, there's a scene very early in the film where we needed sounds to build up suddenly out of nothing, you know, in the space of sort of 7 seconds or even less, actually going from sort of zero to many, many decibels. And I was thinking of just different ways to do it. I don't know what it was, but it sort of occurred to me to layer in the sounds of the city, because I had sort of had synth textures and I sort of felt that they weren't enough, but I needed something else, something other. And on set, I had this folder, which they gave me when I first got hired, of sounds that they recorded in Oakland, you know, so the sound team went around and recorded all these sort of atmospheres and different effects. And part of what they recorded were the train sounds. And so I just started layering them into these sort of, they call it the sort of PTSD textures, these sort of crazy kind of walls of sound. And I think it triggered something for the filmmakers, because you don't necessarily identify them on their own as a train, but when they're layered up, there's some, perhaps something subconscious, you know, for people who have grown up in Oakland, that they might go, sort of, there's something in there that's familiar, but at the same time, it's so quick and so fast that I'm not necessarily identifying it for what it is.
That's absolutely fascinating how that works. The band that you worked with on this project have also worked with Justin Timberlake. They worked on Hamilton. How do you put together the right team after you compose the work? How do you know these are the right guys to assemble the music that you created?
So this is the very unusual and quite extraordinary aspect of doing the music for this film, is because my collaborators on the film, David and Raphael, were musicians themselves, they actually picked the band for me.
Oh, wow.
So they basically, because everything was about Oakland, like all the source music comes from Oakland, and they wanted the musicians to come from Oakland as well. So when we first started working, you know, they're like, hey, Michael, I know you're going to do some horns. We know this fantastic horn section called the Regiment Horns. They're Justin Timberlake's horn section. They're all Oakland. Can we use them? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, of course. You know, David and Raphael met John Mader, the drummer, who was an Oakland drummer, but currently working at the time in Oakland, in Los Angeles, playing the Los Angeles production of Hamilton. So we get this call in the middle of the scoring process. Hey, Michael, we've met your drummer. He's amazing. He's from Oakland. I'm like, okay. And he, you know, John, you know, 2 weeks later, John Mayer turns up at the session and absolutely just kills it. He's fantastic. I think that speaks to the level of trust, you know, that we all had with each other, that I knew that if David and Raphael called me and said, we've got someone amazing, they're from Oakland, I knew that they were going to be amazing, you know, such is their musical background. I mean, they, you know, they're very, very hands-on. They know music. They know the sound that they want. They were sort of my spirit guides through the process. It turned out great. It was one of the coolest things I've ever done.
And I really think a lot of fans of film and TV don't always understand how it works between composer and band. You know, you write the music, you compose the music, and you work with the band to create the sound that you envisioned. How close did everything hit the mark exactly as you wanted? Did it get better because of the collaboration?
Yeah. Well, I think it always gets better, and particularly in the instruments that aren't like notated. So of course the, you know, the brass is all notated. It's note for note. But when you've got someone like a drummer or even a bass player, they're going off chord chart or a rhythm chart, you know, they're going to bring something of themselves to the process. So no matter when you're demoing, I'm sort of, you know, playing the drums myself on the computer, giving an approximation of what it's going to be, playing the bass part myself, giving an approximation of what it's going to be. When someone comes into the studio, just basically reading off a chart, they're going to do things that you don't expect. And what they don't expect is adding to a sort of a greater whole. And it's always drummers in particular. I mean, they just, you know, they always bring something that I'm like, that has just lifted this to somewhere that I had hoped for but didn't expect.
Wow. Blindspotting has been it's been hailed by many critics as one of the most powerful films of the summer. And I think many film fans would agree that the score accentuates everything that happens on screen. How does that feel for you now that you're able to relax and just enjoy the moment?
For me, it's been an honor, like, and something I've been incredibly humbled to be part of a film that is so vital and so relevant. And it's been completely gratifying to me to see the recognition that the film is getting, not only for the work of Raphael and David, but also for Carlos, for the incredible direction that he brought to the film. And, you know, to my friends, Heath Calder and Jess Calder, who I couldn't be more grateful for when they called me and said, would you like to come and talk to us about this film? When I first met the guys, I knew it was going to be an incredibly exciting project. And it was sort of beyond my wildest dreams now to see the reaction that the film is getting, particularly on social media, the way it's finding its audience. In Oakland and beyond. And I think as a composer, as a film composer, you always hope to be part of a process, to be attached to a story that is, you know, relevant, that is vital, that is connecting with an audience. And this is that film for me. I'm just thrilled to have been a part of it.
I think this is gonna take you to another level. Honestly, it's been, everybody I know is talking about this movie in the industry. So that's pretty exciting stuff.
Fantastic. Hopefully, it keeps growing. And you know, I'm also just really excited to see what Raphael and David do next as well. So I think everyone's got hopefully a great future out of this.
Well, hopefully, you'll all be connected for the next thing.
Cool.
I do want to ask, as a composer, is there a big misconception when you talk to people that are fans of what you do in terms of they don't quite understand? Like, what's the biggest misconception in terms of what a film and television composer does?
Well, there are a few. It's funny, like the first question, which I think all composers will attest to, is whenever you tell somebody you're a film composer, they'll be like, oh, great, what instrument do you play? I get that all the time. And it's like, well, yes. I mean, I used to play, you know, yes, I played clarinet, and yes, I grew up playing keyboards in bands and all that kind of stuff. But really, I play the computer. You know, that's my instrument. I'm in the studio, and I'm planning how to attach, you know, or represent drama in a sort of musical form. But yes, so that's one question that I get all the time. But I think the other one is often that, you know, I think the nature of how collaborative the process is often lost. I think, and maybe it's from years past, but I think there was a sense that, you know, the composer was somebody who, you know, worked in a little sort of ivory tower and then turned up at the studio, you know, in front of the orchestra, and suddenly here's the score out of nowhere. You know, these days it is a complete collaboration from beginning to end, and it's a conversation and an incredibly rewarding conversation between composer and filmmakers. And I think that's often misunderstood, that there's a sense that the composer is by themselves, isolated, you know, and just coming up with ideas, and then it's like, here you go, as in there's a lot of risk involved, like what are you going to get? Whereas I think nowadays the process really is about connection, that you know, the best collaborations come because you connect with the story, the script, the material, the performances, but more than anything else, you connect with the filmmakers. You're on the same page. You're in their head. You know exactly what they're trying to achieve, and you become their musical voice.
Wow, that was beautifully put. So what's next? What's next for you, Michael, after this? I mean, I know you got Wolf Creek. Are you doing season 3 of that, or what do you have coming up?
Yeah, I haven't heard at this point about Wolf Creek. Where I have a show which will be coming up on FX networks later this year. I think they've announced September 25th is the date. It's called Mr. In Between, which is very different to Blindspotting, but no less brilliant. It's from Nash Edgerton, and it's a 6-part series about a fixer, sort of a, I wouldn't say a hitman, but a fixer who's looking for deeper connection in his life. And it's just fantastic. I can't recommend it highly enough. So that's what's coming up later in the year. That's the next thing to watch out for.
Well, I would definitely watch that, and I look forward to keeping up with your career as you go forward.
Great. It's so nice to talk to you. Thank you so much.
It's great talking to you. Thanks for stopping by.
All right. Thanks.
All right, bye. There you go. I hope you enjoyed that. I really had a great time having Michael on the show, and I think he is just an interesting and insightful gentleman to talk to. I wish him the best of luck. Again, his score is great, and he does some great work. He worked in the Wolf Creek TV show. He has his new show coming out that he just talked about, and of course, Blindspotting, which is in theaters now, so be sure to check that out. Once again, thank you for listening to the Hollywood Outsider podcast. We try to bring you interviews with filmmakers in the world of independent cinema whenever we can, so I really hope you guys enjoyed this one. Remember to subscribe and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your app of choice. Our normal show has a new episode every single week and is available at thehollywoodoutsider.com. This is Aaron Peterson reminding you that the next time you head into the theater to see Blindspotting, buy popcorn.